Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Some archaeologists are calling for preserving human-made artifacts on Mars.
I don't see a difference between finding a, say, arrowhead in East Africa versus the Curiosity's helicopter broken blade that is now discarded on Mars.
It's Thursday, December 26th, and you're listening to Science Friday. I'm sci-fi producer Charles Bergquist. We've left quite a bit behind in space. Satellites, moon buggies, Mars rovers, even human excrement. Some people have dubbed this space junk. But what if future archaeologists wanted to trace the chronology of space exploration through those items? Should they be preserved? We'll get to that story in a bit, but first, we're going to take a look at how some local communities are taking environmental matters into their own hands and getting results. It's part of a newsletter series called Tiny Nature Triumphs from our digital producer, Emma Gomez, who has those stories.
Ever wonder if that friendly-looking plant in your yard is invasive? And once you find out, what do you do next? Well, there are some programs across the country that aim to convince homeowners to remove invasive species from their yards and gardens. In Hamilton County, Indiana, their trade-in program allows homeowners to replace invasives with a native plant from the area for free. Claire Lane is an urban conservationist at Hamilton County's Soil and Water Conservation District, and she runs that program. Welcome, Claire.
Hi.
So could you tell me something like, roughly how many people's backyards in Indiana have invasive plants, or what does the scale of this look like?
There are so many invasives. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a yard that probably doesn't have one. A lot of these plants have been introduced through the landscape trade and then started escaping into natural areas. And a lot of people don't see that happening because it's not like your invasive plant is getting up and walking out of your yard. So a lot of people think, well, you know, mine's not invasive. But what they don't really see is those birds that are at their burning bush right now picking up the berries and then flying away to a nearby park or roadside and then planting that berry for them. That's how most of these plants spread. And it's conceptually just a little harder for people to follow, but they're so common and so pervasive that really they're pretty much everywhere.
Right. And I mean, even though a lot of them are beautiful, invasive species aren't really that great for the environment of a city because they can reproduce pretty fast. It sounds like they can just take out habitats for native plants. And without those native plants, local insects, pollinators, and other wildlife in the ecosystem suffer, right?
Yeah, those species really are the foundation of our entire ecosystem. You can almost think about it like a house of cards where we're at the top and these insects are that foundation at the bottom. And the invasive species can really tear that whole house of cards down. And we've found that once people are educated about the harm the invasive species cause, they want to be part of the solution and they want to help. And that's the exciting part of all of this. And there are some great native alternatives that you can choose from that have the same great color, but are actually an asset to our environment versus a detriment.
Right. So tell me more about how your trade-in program comes in to solve the problem that you outlined with these invasive plants.
Yeah. So we were finding that a lot of people just didn't know how to get started, maybe knew that they had an invasive species, but weren't sure what to do with it. So this program allows us to help people break it down into some smaller steps. We are there to help people identify what species they have on their property. And then with the trade-in program, they can remove that invasive species and then they apply on our website and they get a coupon code to get for free some native replacements out of our 40 different native species they can choose from.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's less overwhelming than walking into a garden store and not knowing at all where to start and what to look for. So I think that really helps people move along because they have a list of choices right in front of them.
I love that. That's like taking away the decision fatigue of finding a new plan.
Exactly.
Or it's like matchmaking.
Yeah. We hear a lot of, you know, I've wanted to deal with this burning bush or this pear tree or whatever species it is for a long time. I'm so excited that I finally got the push to do it. I'm so excited I have this opportunity to replace it. They get to see and meet other people who are doing the same thing, which I think builds a lot of community and is exciting. So it's really motivating for us and for them because everybody's excited about it.
That is Claire Lane, an urban conservationist with Hamilton County, Indiana's Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thanks.
If you want to see if your yard has invasive plants, Claire recommends doing an online search for your area's list of invasive species. You can also check in with your local Soil and Water Conservation District to learn more about what removal options are available in your area. Speaking of protecting ecosystems, if you've lived in one place for a while, you've probably noticed the landscape change over time. Maybe the trees are bigger or an extreme weather event seriously altered the landscape, but there aren't a lot of great ways to keep track of those changes. That's where Chronolog comes in. It's a series of photo stations set up in natural areas all over the world. You might come across one if you're out enjoying nature, where you'll see a sign inviting any passerby to take a picture of the habitat and upload it to a database, where it then becomes part of a years-long time-lapse video. And researchers can use that video to see how the habitat has changed over time. Jake Rose is a co-founder of Chronolog. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a fan of the show.
Thanks for being here. So do you have like a concrete example of how these Chronolog stations have helped scientists or the communities that they're in?
Yeah, so controlled burns are a really great use case. Some people have a really hard time understanding why you would set fire in the woods. How is setting fire in the woods a good thing? And so scientists will set up two Chronolog photo stations, one in an area that's not managed, that's full of brush, that's kind of ripe for a wildfire, and another time lapse where there's prescribed fire and the forest is manicured, and you can see the difference of a healthier forest. And then there's the things we didn't expect. Scientists will set up a photo station in Florida monitoring one thing, and then Hurricane Helene or Hurricane Ian will blow through, and now it's really important to have a baseline of what the mangroves looked like before the storm, the damage after the storm, how long it takes to recover. It's a great tool for scientists to learn.
That's really cool. So I come across one of these stations, put my phone in, take a picture, and email it to Chronolog. But how do I actually see the time lapse that I'm contributing to?
Yes. So you get an email reply back with the time lapse video. So while you're standing in front of the basin or the river or the desert or the wetland, you get to see how that scene has changed over time while you're still standing in front of it. Every park has a story to tell. When a person is out in nature enjoying that scenery, they want to help in some way. They want to give back. And when you give people an option to do something positive, they take that. And that's showing instead of telling. With science, there's a communications hurdle to get over. And when you can show someone a video, they can see the change. They can understand it. And together, we're creating a living archive of our planet that can inform decisions that shape the future.
Well, thank you so much for answering these questions. And I cannot wait to visit a Chronolog station myself in the near future.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
To find a Chronolog station near you, check out chronolog.io. And finally, when a dead tree in a city gets cut down, where does it go next? Well, the city of Baltimore does something a little special with them. Camp Small is a city-run lumber recycling program that takes dead trees and turns them into mulch, firewood, and sometimes even beautiful furniture. Sean Preston is a woodworker and yard master at Camp Small. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So before Camp Small was Camp Small, I heard it used to be called the Stump Dump, where dead trees would go to be thrown in a landfill. How did it begin its transformation into the recycling center that it is now?
So the Stump Dump was just the five-acre site where Baltimore City Recreation and Parks and Division of Forestry would bring all the material from downed trees throughout the city. You know, it's like on average 2,000 trees come down every year, and this was the site for housing all of that. You know, housing as much as 9,000 tons a year, so that's it fills up a football field, you know, 16, 18 feet high. And it became very evident that the site was just a cost to the city.
Right. So you guys decided to start recycling that wood instead?
Yeah. So they, you know, you walk in the door to us and you're trying to build something at home and you don't really know what you're looking for or quite how to build it. We're longtime woodworkers who have done a lot of that sort of thing, and we take our time to help guide you through it.
So the city hands over dead trees and tree stumps to Camp Small, and then they prepare the lumber to get converted into, like, furniture for businesses or wood for mushroom inoculation. But it goes beyond that, right?
Yeah, I feel like the benefits to our community really stretch wide. I mean, probably the thing that we enjoy the most that we do a lot of is working with city schools to do outdoor classrooms. We're in an urban area, you know, and a lot of the children here don't have good access to natural areas. So we build physical classrooms outside, tables and chairs out of logs so that kids can leave the classroom setting and the teacher can take a group of 30 kids and sit outside on wooden benches and logs and play spaces. You know, we'll truck a whole lot of logs and we set them up so that they create this jungle gym of logs, and we'll cut steps and platforms and make it into this like really fun, engaging, interactive thing for kids.
If I was a tree, that's where I would want to end up. That is so wonderful.
Yes, I agree with that. And also just like how something simple and that's a natural byproduct of nature can become this thing that gathers communities together, that gives children something to play on. We don't need to look at it as a business. We instead are a city service and a public service.
And on a harder note. I know that there was a fire at the yard earlier this month. How are you all managing with the aftermath of that?
Well, it was devastating. You know, we had an accumulation of maybe 5 years worth of logs stacked on our facility, and a fire broke out. We're not really sure how it happened, but we did lose a large inventory of logs. Fortunately, you know, we had the firefighters working really hard to try to save our facilities and our equipment. And when I woke up the next day, I was really relieved that those were still in place. And I think the thing that kind of blew me away was just the response from the community. The amount of people that reached out by phone and by email to offer assistance to us, or just to show the love, like that they love what we're doing and that they see the benefits of what we're doing is just completely inspirational. We're really fortunate to be able to keep our program going pretty much uninterrupted. And we're right back at it today, sawing and sorting and doing what we always do.
That is Sean Preston, the yardmaster at Camp Small. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
For those in the city of Baltimore, if you're looking for lumber, a raised bed for your garden, or just a log to sit on outside, you can get in touch with Camp Small through their website. To read more about these projects, you can find our entire Tiny Nature Triumph series on our website at sciencefriday.com/triumphs. I'm Emma Gomez.
After the break, the argument for preserving artifacts on Mars. Stay with us.
Hi, Ira here, reminding you that Science Friday has a dollar-for-dollar donation match, which means that any donation made through December 31st will be doubled. So now is the time to head over to sciencefriday.com/support and make a gift. Our 2025 programming depends on the generosity of our fans and listeners. Again, that's sciencefriday.com/support, and thanks.
I'm Erin Moriarty of 48 Hours, and of all the cases I've covered, this is the one that troubles me most. A bizarre and maddening tale involving an eyewitness account that doesn't quite make sense. A sister testifying against a brother. A lack of physical evidence. Crosley Green has lived more than half his life behind bars for a crime he says he didn't commit. Listen to Murder in the Orange Grove, the troubled case against Crosley Green, wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the past 60 years or so of space exploration, we humans have left some things behind, I'll put it that way. Be it bits of satellites, moon buggies, Mars rovers, even human excrement, all among the countless pieces of evidence of our presence that some people have dubbed space junk. But what if many, many years from now, future archaeologists want to trace the chronology of space exploration by examining these items we have left in our wake. Shouldn't they be preserved? Well, my next guest argues just that in a new paper in the journal Nature Astronomy. Dr. Justin Holcomb is an assistant research professor at the University of Kansas and the Kansas Geological Survey in Lawrence. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Talk me through your argument here. Why should we be preserving all these artifacts from space exploration?
Yeah, so the general kind of lens through which we see all this material preserved across various celestial bodies in our solar system is not really as space trash or galactic litter, but actually as space heritage or cultural resources. And so we see this material as just the extension of our species' kind of long history of migration, first out of Africa and then out of our atmosphere and into off-Earth environments. And so we just see this kind of long kind of context of our species' history of migration, and the material left behind is essentially the material footprint of that movement.
And how do we go about preserving them? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think that there are simple ways that we're talking about in the sense of just mitigating disturbances to various areas, like not landing exactly on Tranquility Base or where Curiosity rover has driven around on Mars. But, you know, when it comes to legislation, that's something that is being worked on and is a much, you know, kind of thornier problem.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking at all about how these items might be useful for future humans? You know, maybe they could take these parts and use them later?
That's a crucial point, because it's not just the fact that the material left behind is important from a historical context, but that they also become data archives of recording surface conditions on various celestial bodies once they're left behind.
I know that some people are going to be listening to this and thinking aliens will find these things and learn about humans. A good possibility, perhaps?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, why not? I think the idea of keeping things free from disturbance or destruction is for future generations. It could be 1,000 years from now or 100 years from now, or say another, say it was aliens visiting in a million years from now, who knows? But I do think that the idea that these material objects represent more than just trash, they represent a reflection of us, of our presence, is important.
Yeah, as an archaeologist, this is sort of like how we dig up fossils or other things on Earth, right?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I think I don't see a difference between finding a, say, arrowhead or what we would call a projectile point in East Africa versus the Curiosity's helicopter broken blade that is now discarded on Mars. Those are both kind of material representations of human activity and our exploration and our behaviors.
Well, I share your enthusiasm, and I look forward to the day when we can all go out there and find the stuff we left behind.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Dr. Justin Holcomb, assistant research professor at the University of Kansas and the Kansas Geological Survey in Lawrence.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, we ask three experts their picks for the most important science news of the year. Lots of folks helped make this show happen, including
Jordan Smudgick, Rasha
Aridi, Shoshana Buxbaum,
Felissa Mayers,
and many more. I'm Sci-Fi producer Charles Berquist. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.